Welcome to B2B Craftworks, a podcast about B2B writing. Good morning, business writers. With all this COVID-19 craziness going on in the world, your Twitter or whatever you choose to look at social media is probably completely slammed with brands left and right trying to say things. Some of it is helpful and some of it is going to cause problems for them in the next couple weeks. But the topic we have lined up for today is surprisingly on point because we're going to talk about what happens behind the scenes with these brand conversations, which is all part of the game of thought leadership. So before we settle into our official definition or talk about examples, I wanted to ask our guest, Lee Price from Lee Price Ideas, one question, which is what is the best thing and the worst thing about writing thought leadership?
Hi, Sarah. That's a good question. So the best thing is that if you are ghostwriting thought leadership, you're working with the thought leader, you're getting to really bring someone's good ideas out into the world in a way that they haven't been able to do that on their own. So you're really helping good ideas shine, which is, I think, what writers want to spend their time doing, right? So that's fun and that's exciting, but it's also the hardest thing because I think that ghostwriting thought leadership is some of the hardest writing that marketing writers do. There's a learning curve, but it's a fun challenge. I obviously like it a lot. I've chosen to kind of focus my career on doing this kind of writing. So there's a learning curve, but it's completely worth it. And you can turn out some really interesting content.
Yeah, and we're gonna get into why that's so important, I think. But first, maybe in the way of an introduction, how would you summarize some of that experience you've had with thought leadership?
Yeah, so I started as a writer. I was an English major in college. I went to Virginia, so close to where you are, Sarah. And I wanted to be a novelist. That's what I've wanted to do since I was a little kid. I used to climb trees and write stories. And so that's what I thought I was going to do as a career. I graduated during the last recession in 2008. So it's a great time to be a liberal arts major. And I accidentally became a marketer because I couldn't find any jobs at publishing companies or doing the kind of writing that I thought I wanted to do then. And so I became a marketer at a kind of like a hybrid tech business publishing company. And that was 12 years ago. And I've been a marketer since then, focused on using my writing and communication skills to help companies tell their stories. So I've done everything. I've been an in-house marketer at a consumer products company, which was really interesting. I've made YouTube videos about products companies were trying to sell. But then for the past 7 years, I worked at a B2B content marketing agency. So our primary content was written content. We started really in the business blogging heyday around 2010.
It was an interesting time.
It was a different time. It's when your dentist decided they needed a blog, right? So somebody had to write that content. And I've just watched the industry really change and mature. And I think that it's a more exciting time than ever to be in B2B content because I think there's some really interesting stuff going on. The formats that I've worked on have really evolved over time. So it's gone from mostly written blog content when people still read blogs to a whole variety of stuff. I do a lot of podcasts now, which I think is some of the most interesting thought leadership that's coming out is in the form of podcasts and video shows. There's cool stuff going on with audio. So through all of it, from being an early brand new college grad to now, I've had to really learn how to work with smart people who have good ideas, but maybe aren't so great at getting them out or turning them into digestible, easy to understand content. And so that's been kind of the fun challenge that I've always tried to figure out. And that's something that I still really have fun trying to do. So hopefully I can share some tips of what I've learned along the way.
I love that. Because, you know, I think people may not be able to agree on a lot right now, but we certainly agree a recession could be coming. And I think stories just get more important during that time. So people may not want to pay a lot for them, but like in the form of a novel or something like that. But I think finding those stories and bringing them out in relation to products is going to be the way to keep conversations going in marketing.
Yeah, and sometimes in tough times, you have to get more creative too. I mean, I definitely have had periods of having to get very creative about how I sell my skills and how I help people. So I think we're probably facing a time like that again. And it can be scary, but it's also a time to really stretch yourself.
Yeah, and it's just so important for brands to be stepping up with leadership right now. So writing this kind of content, I feel like I heard it just fly to the top of everyone's lists when they woke up like on Monday to figure out how their leadership is going to, you know, talk about what's happening right now.
Yeah. So I want to make sure we talk about that too, because I think it's really hard for people right now to know what to say. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to make sure that if you don't feel like you're an expert on what's going on right now, that's okay. And you don't have to play one, right?
Yeah.
You can contribute in other ways. If you
want to amplify that.
Yeah. Just staying true to what you can contribute and what you know about and how you can help, and matching that with what your audience needs, I think is more important than ever right now, because I see a lot of people that I can tell, like, feel like they need to be leading in a certain way. But if you don't feel comfortable doing that, or that's not you, or that's not your brand, it can kind of backfire. So I think staying true to what you know about is important right now.
I love it. So if we get into like an actual definition of thought leadership, because I think this is also a term that attained buzzword status and then kind of got hit with people hating on it and saying they never want to see that word again. I've always been kind of okay with the term because it feels really accurate to what kind of content it is. You know, it's not discovery or problem solving. It's like setting someone's perspective into, I actually took that from you in your email list, but it's more about perspective than it is about anything else. So how would you kind of define that as a general term, or then how it relates to brands, or how it relates to, you know, the practice of creating thought leadership?
Yeah, so I probably talk about this differently every time I talk about it. And there's been a lot of really interesting conversation about what thought leadership means within our little industry recently. People like to argue about this, and I'm all in with that. Andy Crestidina just put out some interesting research, actually, about what thought leadership is, and it was survey-based. So it was asking B2B marketers how they define thought leadership, what makes a thought leader. Because some people, you're right, don't like the term. They think it's like being an influencer, right? Like someone just decides one day that they're a thought leader and they just start posting Twitter threads and then they're important or something, right? But I really think of thought leadership, again, as a marketer, I think of thought leadership as a way to really share your ideas, your ideals, your vision, your perspective, your expertise. And I define thought leadership as coming from a person, always coming from a human. So if you are the founder of the company, it is very likely that your ideas and your thought leadership overlap almost perfectly with your brand's positioning and your brand's values. But, you know, let's say that you work for a much bigger company and you're just one person on a team of maybe, you know, 40 leaders who are running decisions, you might have your own unique voice that overlaps partly with the brand, but you bring your own experience and perspective, maybe not even with that company, from your, you know, past work or other things that you've experienced. So I see thought leadership as one person's ideas and perspective again. That's driving a conversation in an industry about work somehow. And I say that because I've always worked in B2B. So everything I do is about work, right? It's helping people at work.
Yeah.
And I think the word perspective, like you said, is really important to me because I don't think it's necessarily about your expertise. I don't think that's that interesting to people. Just the fact that you know a lot. I think it's really telling the stories about how you earned that expertise. So instead of just, you know, like, this is the way that we do this, telling how you learned that or how you developed your framework for doing your work, or the mistakes that you made to get there. People really like to hear, you know, not just what you know, but how you figured it out.
Yeah, and I love that because I think that unlocks who's allowed to put thought leadership out, because you don't have to be just the Seth Godin of the industry and no one else is allowed to speak, because you never know what about your experience or the way you think about things or the way you process failure is going to change somebody else. So it really comes back to being about the person who's reading, and humans are so creative. We can learn anything from anybody. So you really never know what piece of thought leadership even if it's from somebody who's, you know, just run $1 or $2 million companies, like that's not enough. Even at that small a scale, any one piece of thought leadership could have a positive impact for someone or change how they think about something. So that's why it just seems like such a limitless topic.
It is. And I think another important buzzword right now is authenticity. Mm. And I think that really applies.
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability. Yeah, but that really applies for thought leadership, I think, now more than ever, because it's hard to, like I said, take someone's expertise if you don't understand who they are and how they got there, and if you can't put yourself in their shoes. So I think a pillar for a thought leader, something that's really important that they have to be willing to do, is they have to be willing to put themselves out there and share and be honest and reflective. And there are a lot of leaders who are very smart, but who are not willing to do that. They're not ready to, including many who I've worked with. I've had to tell people before, you know, you are great at your work. You need to keep on doing it. But this thought leadership role is clearly not one that you're interested in, right? Because you have to be willing to put in the work and put in the thinking and really develop your perspective and share it freely with the public, basically.
So it's almost like business therapy in public. You have to be willing
completely. Therapy is a great word. Yeah,
what you've done and learn from it, which
and
is
be a like little takes, raw. Yeah.
That takes some emotional intelligence, which is really interesting, is coming out as a really valuable quality in executives and CEOs, as that emotional intelligence quotient. It's interesting to see those things overlap in kind of pop culture, or B2B pop culture, whatever that is. So cool. So when we start to look at the practice of doing that, so I think a lot of writers are getting assignments where, you know, we want to create a piece of thought leadership, schedule something with the executive, and deliver an article. There's a lot of ways to go about doing that to be successful. So I was thinking we could provide kind of that general process you approach when you are putting together a piece of thought leadership.
Sure. Okay.
Six steps.
Let's walk through a scenario. Do you want to walk through the steps you've outlined? How do you want to do this?
Yeah, that would be neat. So I am a B2B marketer, and I've approached you to say, I have this sweet executive who wants to talk to you about B2B stuff. let's create some thought leadership, since the first step is, you know, identifying that subject matter expert.
Right. Okay. And we talked a little bit about how to identify someone who's a good candidate to be a thought leader. And so I'm looking for ideas, someone who has ideas, someone who has expertise and perspective. Maybe they've never really polished it for an outside audience, but you know that they have it. And someone who is ready to talk about it, right? So they're ready to share. They're not going to keep their cards too close to their chest. Even if they are not a vulnerable personality type or they're not a casual personality type, like you can still be very formal, which a lot of B2B brands and thought leaders want to be, and still be willing to openly share your experience in a way that you feel comfortable with. So that's who I'm looking for. The ideas are the most important part. You would be surprised how many business leaders think that they're going to get on the phone with a ghostwriter and the ghostwriter is going to provide the ideas. If you're getting into ghostwriting and you're out there, that's not how it should work, right? Like you help them bring out their ideas. You are kind of a conduit. They are the voice. We can talk more about how I've learned how to do that. So that's who I'm looking for. And then, so let's say someone comes to you as a writer and they say, okay, I want you to put out a LinkedIn article, let's say, with this thought leader, and they're really busy, but they have 30 minutes next week to talk to you. So you're going to get a 30-minute phone call with this person. And often that's all you get. So those 30 minutes, like that is a high priority phone call. That's your go time. You need to be ready to go and you need to be ready to really think on your feet and get the best stuff you can out of this person in 30 minutes. Knowing based on my experience that usually the most interesting stuff comes in the last 5 minutes of that 30-minute call. Yes. I mean, I think anyone who spends a lot of time on the phone talking to people they don't know for work, which I do, I often have phone calls with people once, you really got to bring your extrovert and your charmer out a little bit, right? Because you have to be able to develop a relationship with someone really quickly, knowing that they are busy and distracted, and figure out what their most interesting ideas are and ask the follow-up questions that you need to find about those ideas. if I'm given an assignment and I don't have a topic that I'm going into the call with, I know that I'm hunting for my topic. So hopefully I know something about the brand's goals, what they're trying to do with this piece, what their marketing goals are. I can research all that I can about the person I'm talking to in advance. I can look at what they've done in their career, if they've written anything online. But a lot of times you don't really know what you're going to get from someone until you get on the phone or you get to the meeting with them. So it's working quickly, but in a way that really makes the other person feel comfortable. So that is my goal, is to make them feel comfortable so that they can give me their best stuff, because that's my job. I'm a hunter. I'm hunting for their best ideas that I can turn into something that I can write about.
Yeah. And it's really, I love that the focus on making them comfortable, because otherwise, if you're approaching this call like it's a widget, like you're just going to check off your box and the interview has happened, yeah, you might get some notes, but you don't know if they're going to be notes that you can use. So approaching it more like a dinner party where you really, I try to get them to laugh in the first 5 minutes or so, just to take the pressure off. And it's not always well done, but I, you know, even if you fail at that, you kind of end up getting a laugh, even if it's at your expense. But making sure that you're doing things that set them at ease, like start explaining exactly what you're hoping to get out of the call.
That's a good point. They often come to the call not knowing who you are or why you're talking to them. So you need to be, ready to tell
them. Or like how this is going to proceed. So yes. I might start with, I have two goals. One is to get background information, just to make sure this article is really on point for whoever's reading. And then the other is to capture actual quotes from you. And so those you'll be able to approve and check, blah, blah, blah. But when they know like how this information will be used, especially at the executive level, because they're always going to be kind of politically aware of that, it can set people at ease a bit at the start.
That's a good point. Tactically, I would say I always record phone calls and I tell the person right away. I ask them if it can be recorded. It depends on what state you're in, but most states require that you get the permission of the other person on the other end. I didn't know that for a while.
Yeah.
So hot tip, ask the person if you can record the call. And then I let them know that I'm recording it for my own notes, but like you said, they're going to review any draft that comes out. So that way they are able to talk freely without feeling like they have to give you a quote. Right? I would be careful about that word. I think people can make them very nervous. And then they just come at you with jargon and that's boring. I'm trying to get them to talk to me just like I'm a person. So they forget that I'm a writer, because that freaks people out. So I'm trying to just get them to talk completely off the cuff. I'm actually trying to knock them off their corporate script. If they have any media coaching or they've, done PR work, PR kind of content before, they're going to be on script. They know the company message. They know, who they're supposed to be and how they fit into it. But a lot of times I'm trying to get them to just go off of that path a little bit so that I can get something juicy and interesting, because that's what their audience wants.
Yeah. I'm laughing a little bit because I totally had that interview a couple weeks ago where I did my research. So I had read a couple other interviews and watched a couple other videos. And then while we were talking, she just so perfectly, seamlessly switched into the exact line that had been used in another thing. And it wasn't just like a phrase. It was like, just like 20 words verbatim. But it was just so, it was the exact same thing, but it also fit into what we were talking about. And it was just a very surreal experience. So yeah, knowing that you're trying to knock them off their script, that's huge.
Yeah, but that was helpful for you that you had done your research about the other content that that person had been a part of, because that way you can ask follow-up questions instead of thinking like, oh, great, I got my nugget. You're like,
there it is. Yeah.
This is already out there. What else can we add to that conversation here? It's all about building on whatever they've already said.
Yeah. Cool. So we've got identifying a topic, interviewing a subject matter expert. And I had one point just that a lot of the times, I think when you're new or intermediate to interviewing people, you can get kind of nervous about the conversation. And maybe to a lesser extent with executives, because they're so used to talking to new people and getting right to their positioning, they might not be nervous. But definitely when you're talking to subject matter experts, so people with a degree or just very specific experience in a field, a lot of the times I get the sense they're more nervous than I am. And once I realized that and realized that as the person giving the interview, you actually have a lot of power to make them feel comfortable and help them get to the most important part of their message, That took away a lot of that anxiety of hopping on the phone, because now it feels more like, you know, I'm here to make you feel good and talk about your ideas rather than I'm here to grill you about the things you know and possibly correct you for what you know.
Right. And you have a shared goal, right? Your shared goal is to make them sound really good. So if they feel like you are on their team, like you're working for them, right? You're trying to make them sound good. And so a sign for me that a thought leadership interview is going really well is when they talk for a while about something and I listen and I take notes and I say, okay, what I hear you saying is simple sentence, like 10 words. And they're like, wow, yeah, that is what I'm saying. So they feel like you've heard them. And they also understand then that your skill you're bringing to the table is turning a lot of big ideas that are not organized in their head because they've never had to be into a really clear takeaway. And when they hear that and that light bulb moment goes off, I mean, that's how you'll keep getting work, first of all, because it shows that you're good at this. But it also really makes that person feel comfortable. And they're like, okay, what else can I give this person so that they can turn it into these easy sentences for me? Because then they understand what you're bringing. They know what they're bringing. Then they understand what you're going to do.
Yeah. And that it's a safe and painless process of doing that.
Yes. And that you're going to help them. Yeah. That you're really valuable to them.
I'll do a similar one of like, you know, a big theme I'm hearing from you is blank. And then I'll, you know, repeat something that could apply to multiple situations they've talked about. And then that tends to really encourage more specific examples because they'll say, yeah, that's right. It's like this one time when blank, 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 which is really helpful for white papers or anything longer form or case studies where you need to get actual details about what's happening.
Right. Right. Well, and you said the word therapy before too. Sometimes when you point out big themes, sometimes it's a surprise to them. They're like, wow, that is true. You know, if you say something like, it sounds to me like, it's really important for you in your process to be honest with your customers or something like that, something positive, they can really have that light bulb moment again, where they realize that because it's, I don't know, our own work is not always obvious to us. Telling it to someone else is what really makes some of those themes and I don't know, it makes uniting elements become really clear.
I think that needs to be like your productized offering is like content therapy.
I actually
like working through. Yeah.
Yeah. I used to run a podcast with the brand managing editor, and that was one of our big episodes was called Content Therapy, where we actually did a therapy session about content.
Perfect. Yeah. There it is. Then that is what was floating around my mind to come up with that because I was watching for that. Cool. And so I think before we get into capturing their voice, which I think is a really important part of the process, I have a 6-part, what's that called where it's abbreviated? Acronym. For coming up with some questions. And this might be more applicable, again, for the subject matter expert kind of conversation, but I think there's some overlap here where you can approach building your question list with COCO, so COCOA, context, offer, customer, opposite, and anything else. So I'll typically start with a really low ball or slow ball question to let people warm up and get into the context. But if it's too simple, I think that's going to turn people off as well. So I try to start with something that's big picture, like what's happening in the industry or what's changing about their customer demographic to get people fired up and really opinionated about what's happening with their company. Then that might lend into, you know, why is it happening now? Why is it urgent? Why hasn't this happened before? What's influencing it? And all of these things are things that people at the executive level are really alert to and interested in. Then I like to ask about how the topic relates to the company's offer. So where does the product or service fit in the discussion? What makes that new, interesting, or helpful? How are customers reacting to it? And one of my favorites is, you know, customers who aren't going with the solution, what are they doing instead? So kind of what are their options that they're thinking about? Because then in your thought leadership, that might open up questions about you know, how to answer all of those different opportunities with the value proposition of the company, which sounds a little complicated now that I said it out loud.
But no, I would just, you know, you're zooming back into the audience, right? Customer and audience, if those are interchangeable, Because that's a question I often ask. If people are kind of stumped or don't know what to talk about, I'll say, what are your customers really stressed out about right now? Mm. And that's the same question you're going for. You're trying to figure out what the audience's perspective is and how you can help them with this piece.
When people, you know, if you're saying customers, if they don't go with our product, they go with A, B, or C, that kind of opens up later questions where you can ask, like, why isn't A good enough? Mm-hmm. Why isn't B or C good enough? What are they missing out on if they aren't addressing those things? So it kind of, it lets you like spiral or spread out a little web of questions from that one question. So the next one, I think I kind of already got to it, but customer, you know, how does it affect prospective customers? How are customers solving this problem now and why doesn't that work? And then I also like to ask about the opposite of whatever you're asking about. So I think this really quickly gets to what is at stake. So what happens if a company doesn't make the change that we're talking about? Or what happens if they ignore this topic? Can they do that and still be successful? And then that tends to draw up really good, big, like evidence-based, if they don't do this, you know, they're gonna fail in the next 3 years and here's why, that kind of conversation. And then I think you'll probably get to this in much more detail, but the last question, you know, because that last 5 to 10 minutes are so important, I always like to save, you know, did anything else come up that you think is important to talk about for this topic that we haven't addressed yet? Because that lets them really review in their mind what we've talked about and what might be missing from that, or take it to a future location that you haven't gotten to yet. Mm-hmm.
Another way that I ask that sometimes is, okay, we've talked about all of this. When someone reads this article, let's say, what do you want to make sure that they know? Or what do you want to make sure that they take away from this? Because that can help them just really give you their clearest takeaway that they're probably able to talk about after 30 minutes that they might not have been able to lead the conversation with. Sometimes it takes, a lot of times you're talking to people who are busy and they might not have had any time to prepare or think about your conversation until they picked up the phone. And then they're still like, who is this? What are we doing right now? So it takes them a while to work through it. And the end of the conversation is when you're looking to them to summarize their big ideas.
So for the next question, thinking about the actual writing process where you're trying to capture someone's voice, we got to talk to Hillary Weiss about that a couple weeks ago, and we came up with this neat definition that brand voice is your customers won't be surprised when you pick up the phone, because it's not going to sound dramatically different from all of the case studies and website content that you have up there. So I wonder, from your perspective, what are some things that you do or that you think writers should think about when they're trying to capture a thought leader's voice?
Yeah. So ghostwriting in someone else's voice is an acquired skill, right? I have a really clear voice that I like to write in. That is not the voice that my clients need from me, though, right? They're not hiring me to write in my voice. They're hiring me to write in their voice. And I think it's helpful to think about the brand voice first, like you were just talking about. So you know what the overarching brand voice is. But again, thought leaders are a single person. So it's about getting to know that person. Sometimes on this 30-minute phone call, you get a lot to gather here. But people give you a lot of rich information from 30 minutes on the phone, especially when it's one-to-one. I prefer to do interviews one-to-one if at all possible. You don't want a marketing rep or a PR Absolutely. Rep on the phone if you can help it, because you really are trying to develop a connection and get to know someone one-to-one. And it makes it so much easier without anyone else. Same for if I'm trying to interview someone's clients. I really try to do it without them on the phone, because a client will just speak so much more freely if they're just talking to you. So anyway, the way that I get to know their voice is I try to come up while I'm on the phone with them with adjectives to describe this person's persona. Okay. Often that one of those adjectives is formal, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not my preferred way to write. And it's not my preferred personality type, but that's often what you get, is brands, you know, a lot of B2B professional service brands, especially, are old school, traditional, formal. And if that is the case, that is really one thing that I have had to learn by making some mistakes and through some experience, is that if a brand voice is formal and a person's voice is formal, you got to respect that, even if it's not your thing. That doesn't mean it has to be boring or hard to understand, but some brands are just going to be formal. Mm-hmm. So that's an important one to watch out for, I think. So then while I'm talking to the person, I'm trying to come up with the adjectives to describe them, right? Like, are they open? Are they friendly? Are they cautious? Are they nurturing? You know, you can get to know a lot about that person in that 30 minutes. So while you're talking to them, your goal is to get the content. Number one, you're trying to get your big ideas so that you can write about it, but you're also trying to kind of build out this web around that of who is this person? What are they like? What is going to make them comfortable? You know, when they read my draft, what would make them, you know, just completely horrified, right? Because like I said, I think formal is a good example. Some formal leaders and formal brands would be horrified if you started hunting for personal details, for example. So we're shooting for the story, but we have to do it in the context of that brand and that thought leader every time. I mean, I'm thinking of an example where one time I was writing new website copy for a B2B company, and their bios for their people were just really black and white, really boring. And so I had the idea to inject some personality, like most companies are doing now, and have one personal fact about each person at this company.
Oh gosh, very formal. What did you discover?
Their facts were things like, he lives in Connecticut. I suggested pets. I was trying not to even get about people's families because a lot of times people don't want to disclose any information about their children or anything like that. But man, I couldn't get hobbies. I couldn't get pets. I could maybe get where they lived.
Off LinkedIn.
Yes. Or that's what they were willing to disclose about themselves personally. So you really just got to read the room, understand both the brand and the audience that they're speaking to. You know, a lot of business audiences just have different expectations from companies than they do in other settings, right? So in this setting, you're not a journalist. There's also a big argument online about whether content marketing is journalism. In this case, you work for the brand. You work for the thought leader. You want to make their voice shine. You want to make it as interesting and personality fueled as possible. But that has really been a sticking point for me in several client relationships where I wanted to make it more fun or more casual maybe than they were prepared to do. And you're just wasting your own time if you try to push for that when that's not who they want to be. At the same time, a lot of times you can really get to know someone and make them comfortable bringing out more of themselves and bringing more of their personal experiences and stories to the conversation. But often the first project is not the time to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can see, you know, that's part of what you bring to a client relationship is, you know, showing them all their options or maybe showing the benefits of what they could be doing if they're a little more fun or let loose, but also not letting that create tension so that you're this force trying to change who they are, or how they present themselves. Because already that process of writing and ghostwriting for brands, if they're just getting into it, they're already nervous about that. So if they're nervous about the format and then they're nervous about the person putting them out there, that's just not a recipe for a long-term relationship.
Right. They want to be able to see themselves in the draft that you wrote. So getting to the draft process. So once you've finished your conversation, you've gotten all the information you need from the rest of the marketing team about what this piece is supposed to do for the company. Then when you put your draft together, again, you have two goals. The first goal is to put for the best ideas and the best content in the most interesting way. But the second, again, because this is by a human, is to get their voice and their perspective and experience in there so that it couldn't have been written by anyone at the company or anyone in the industry. You want it to be really clear who has written that. And so the goal when you send the thought leader your draft is for them to feel like they could have written that, right? And sometimes if you've worked with someone for a while, especially people who are kind of, you know, visionary leader, big ego types, they start to feel like they did write it, right? Like maybe you really polished their ideas into a new framework they didn't have before, and they just kind of take that as their own. I would look at that as a compliment as a ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. You want to feel like you really have just streamlined your relationship in a way that you can make them sound great every time. Maybe they'll have some tactical questions or changes to the way you describe things. You know, if I am describing a thought leader's process and I didn't fully understand it, I write it the way I think they were describing it, and then I'll flag a note like, is this correct? And I have found that for things that really fall in their wheelhouse, if I can acknowledge when I send them the draft, this is what I heard you saying, but I'm not sure I got this totally right? Like maybe there's some complicated technical issue that I don't understand here. Mm-hmm. I like to flag that just so that they don't read it and they, when they read it, they see that you knew this might not be right. Yeah. Instead of reading it and saying, ugh, she didn't get this at all. This isn't right.
Yes.
You know, you want to kind of get ahead of that a little bit, especially in a new relationship. So what do you want to work?
Perfect.
Move to now working through edits.
Yeah. So, you know, part of that process, I love that you highlighted, you know, the first draft you send, you don't have to assume it's perfect and that any edits you get means you have failed. I think if anything, a lot of the tension came out of the editing process for me when I used Ash Amberge's idea to show your notes. So especially with a new client, the first draft I send has just like notes all down the side.
Like an outline. The more
concentrated the topic, like if it's conversion copywriting or a case study, it's going to have more notes. But even just calling out certain word choices, if you think it's kind of a risk, but you want to encourage them to take it, that kind of thing can make them see that what you're doing is strategic and on purpose, mm-hmm. and not just, you know, take it or leave it. This is the kind of work you're going to get from me. So, you know, calling out places where, you know, if we have more statistics to add here, that'd be great. Cause you just said it kind of, you know, it improved everything, but you didn't say by how much. Showing them that this is a piece that together you're going to make really strong, mm-hmm. I think makes you stand out as a ghostwriter. So is there anything else kind of in that editing process?
I think there's a lot of education that the writer can bring to the client about the editing process. So like I said, I worked for a long time in an agency, and we often worked with clients who, it was obvious to us that there would be rounds of edits, right? We send you a draft, you review, there are some changes you want to make, some structural stuff you want to move around. You give us that feedback, we fix it in 24 hours, and then it's ready to go, right? Easy peasy.
Yeah.
So we did this all day. A lot of people are not used to that process. So for them, if they get a draft and it comes to their desk and they're all excited because they've hired this new writer to work with mm-hmm. them, and they read it and they literally see one thing, like, oh, this isn't right. This scenario has played out for me so many times. And so they don't write you back.
It feels like my life.
Yeah, they don't write you back. A week later, maybe you finally follow up with them like, hey, did you get this draft? What do you think? No response. Or they'll respond, this just isn't working. Mm. Right? So if you ever get that email, this just isn't working, after you've heard no feedback at all, I try to get on the phone with the person. I say, let's talk through this. Let's talk about your feedback. We expected there to be feedback. When you get on the phone, I can't tell you how many times I've had the experience that the person says, well, this one word wasn't what I wanted, or I don't like this one sentence, can we take it out? And you're like, this is what we've waited weeks to talk about. Sure, it's gone, whatever, let's move on, you know?
Yeah.
Or I understand why you would say that, thank you for letting me know, I won't do that again. Or, you know, let's say that you use serial commas and they don't do that as a brand, and they were hung up on that. I mean, writers are used to getting edits, right? Most people who are writing professionally are used to having their work completely torn apart. So clients' mm-hmm. little changes are not going to hurt your feelings. So if you can lead the conversation about that and let your client know at the beginning of the process that you expect there to be rounds of edits, a lot of writers include that in their contract. You know, we will work through two or three or whatever your number is. We'll work through two rounds of edits, let's say. So that you're both clear how long you're going to spend working on this piece together, and that you both know from the front that, you know, you're not going to deliver the perfect draft on the first try without any feedback at all.
Mm. So. Yeah, I want to add here, though, the goal is always to do that, to not have huge structural changes when you're at the first draft phase. And I really like Chris Gillespie from Findaway Media has an article out that really breaks down that process and kind of points out those points of no return. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like when you have that kickoff call, that's the point of no return on the topic. Like you have everyone signed off. The topic is not going to change when you get the first draft. Otherwise you're going back to the beginning and doing a change of scope and everything. So the next one I think is, you know, at the outline phase, like here is how we're going to address this. We're going to point out three things that so-and-so needs to do to be successful in this industry. You know, just whatever that format is or the approach, even though the underlying content might change. And that's a point of no return where, you know, they can't see the first draft and say, well, I want to talk about 12 things, not three things in depth, like, you know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, knowing that they're in a defined editorial process, I think really builds your authority as the writer who's guiding them through this. So that's a great opportunity to make sure your process is really defined and clear.
Yeah, totally agree. Those checkpoints along the way. And I think the only thing I would add to that is even if the marketing team you're working with understands that and you have defined your checkpoints along the way, the thought leader they bring in for you to talk to often is not familiar with that.
Yes.
And they weren't even a part of the conversations with the marketing team, right? They don't know any of that. So for them, and this is where I see these long silences come in, it's with the thought leader. So if they get it, and for some reason, if it doesn't just sing completely true to them, I especially have noticed that Midwesterners, who are my favorite people to work with, are most guilty of this, right? Because they don't want to give you anything negative. They're not going to say anything that they think is not nice about your work. So they just won't say anything. Yes. And you have to really work hard to get them to tell you what they like and don't like. So yes, often thought leaders are not used to the editorial process and they need to be clued in. And you just have to be really direct with them until you get your feedback.
Yeah. And I'm you're giving me vivid flashbacks, traumatic flashbacks too. I think especially in the white paper process, which is more long form and more what I do, it's really important to have the subject matter expert, if not involved and like on those kickoff calls, at least a part of that approval process. Because we had a situation where we did a original data survey with just a huge global brand. We got these findings. We identified like, well, here's what these companies are doing correctly. And that's what we're going to focus on. We're at the end of the process and we finally talk to the executive and he says, no, that's not really what they're doing right. Here's what they're doing right. And just completely changed what the entire section was going to be about. So we kind of had to go back to the drawing board and look at the data and, you know, figure out how we were going to package that. Whereas if he had been involved, you know, maybe three checkpoints before, we could have headed that off and not had a really stressful turnaround time. So that, yeah, I love
been there.
That we're calling that out. Yeah, and so our final point as we get down to the last couple minutes is tying it back to marketing. And I think that's something B2B writers are getting better at, but not always super oriented to. So I would love that perspective from your experience.
Yeah. And so this is something I've been thinking about a lot right now too. Like we talked about at the beginning of the conversation, you know, we're in the middle of this global crisis. People aren't really sure how to market right now. They're not sure how to position themselves and their expertise. And it's been a hard time for me to give people good advice because no one can make great decisions right now. We don't have a lot of information to work from always. And people aren't sure what to do with their voice right now. So thought leaders, I think, are a little flummoxed. And so this is a time to return to some core truths, I think. And so what I've been helping people work through is, okay, let's figure out an overlap here. And the overlap we're looking for is, what does your audience need right now? And what can you provide either from yourself, from your own experience? You know, let's say I've led companies through major crises before. I have some experience I could share then that would help people who are flummoxed right now. Or maybe I don't have it. I don't know what to share right now. I don't have any expertise. I don't know the answers to tell people because I don't know answers for my own business, right? In that case, I think that the company and the person can still be a thought leader because they can go out and find answers, right? So they're going to create, they're going to find that overlap because they know what their audience needs. And they know that they either have the connections or the resources to help people find those answers. So this is something that I recommend to people a lot. Even if you don't feel like you can be an expert today on what your audience needs, you can be a curator who goes out and finds those answers for them, who does new research maybe, who is going out and digging up the answers for your audience. And so that's how I think we tie it back to marketing too. Like your overlap is between what your customers need from you, what your prospects need from you, and what you're able to provide either through your products and services or through your marketing. And if you think about it like that, it makes it really simple and it makes it easier to see a path forward, I think.
Yeah, I love that because, you know, that really takes the pressure off from having this all-encompassing solution for your customers. If you're thinking, you know, here are the five things keeping them up at night. Here are the five things I know. There's an overlap of one. Boom, I have confidence and I know what to say. And I think that would keep people from sending things that are out of touch. And I keep in my mind. I think, did you write about the FreshBooks CEO sending out a COVID alert? Or
no, I wrote about Basecamp. I don't know what FreshBooks said. What did they do?
Yeah, and nothing bad. And I use FreshBooks. I love the program. I build my business on that. But his notice seemed like really random. And it was just a, hey, everybody, I know we're all worried about COVID. I just bought $2,000 of lunches. And here's why I think you should do that too. And it just felt like so, it didn't feel like his expertise or my interest at that level. So the way you just explained that, I think that highlights where that disalignment came from for me, because it wasn't about, you know, small businesses that invoice online, and it wasn't about his area of expertise in online invoicing. Right. And so while it's a great gesture, it was very tone deaf for me, where that was one of the announcements I was more likely to delete than the ones I'm going to take a screenshot and share.
Right. Yeah, I think in uncertain times, I mean, the kind of leadership I'm looking for from other people is just really open and authentic. And so back to our original definition of what it means to be a thought leader, it doesn't mean that you have all the answers, and it doesn't mean that you are an expert on stage necessarily. Mm. It means that you are thinking publicly. You are sharing your thinking. So if my thinking right now is, I don't know what to do. This is terrifying. Is my business going to survive? What do I do? How do I help my people? If that's what I have to share right now and I'm comfortable doing it, I think that that can be thought leadership too. Seeing people raise their hands and say, I don't know the answers right now. These are the things that I'm thinking through. This is how I'm trying to make decisions. This is my framework. How are you doing it? Like creating a conversation in a community, even around uncertainty, I think can be thought leadership too. And that's so much more helpful and comforting to me as someone who's also trying to answer a lot of questions right now than getting 85 million emails from people who have never worked from home before about how to work from home. I'm like, thanks, but that's not like my main problem right now. And most people's main problems are not the tactics of how to work from home, right? I mean, if you've never done it before, it is certainly a challenge and a stretch. And I think some of that advice is helpful. But you know, find your lane, find that overlap between what your customers need and what you could actually provide. And if today is day two of ever working from home for you, you might not be the expert right now on working from home, but there's probably something that would be helpful for you to think about publicly.
Yeah. I love that. Cause even just the process of watching someone, in a position of power, experiencing uncertainty and not panicking about it, even if they are concerned and changing things, that is leadership to me. So that's something I would love to see examples of, people like making those thought processes or sharing.
Yeah, and breaking it down, how they made those decisions. Yeah, I think that's what we're all looking for. So yeah, one of the last things I would say about ghostwriting for thought leadership is that it really is a position that brings a lot of power, right? So you are helping people deliver their ideas, figure out what their ideas are, and share them. And I think that B2B thought leader ghostwriters really are in a position where they can help people, where they can deliver better ideas to the world, where they can simplify really tough technical ideas and push people towards thinking and content that is generous, helpful, kind. I mean, I see that as my role, is kind of pushing people towards their best ideas that bring out the best in themselves and their companies. So I would take this position very seriously because I think that it's one where you can really make some big changes.
I love that. And I love, you know, pulling out those interview skills now, like hearing those themes of being a part of making marketing better and making this something that actually does educate and inform and do all those things that non-scammy marketing is supposed to do, because it works better. So yeah, just wins all over the place.
But fun.
Thank you so much for your time and expertise today. And I think the best place to find you is Lee Price Ideas and your amazing newsletter, right? Is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I send out a newsletter every other Friday. My goal for 2020 was to make thought leadership cool again. If people stop hating that as a word, I might have some new goals given the new context of this year. So I'm just along on the ride like everybody else is. But yes, you can find me and sign up for my newsletter at leeprice ideas.com.
Some great next steps if you are new to the podcast is to head over to b2bwritinginstitute.com and check out some of the resources we have there. We've just installed a super cool facet filtering thing that makes it really easy to navigate some of the who's who of B2B writing, where you could find your next great coach or course or mentor. We've also been releasing once a week a featured B2B writer. These are active B2B writers who have built their freelance agency or in-house careers, just learning B2B writing and generally building a community around it. So these are great people to connect with in your network and get great examples of writer portfolio sites and niches and all different things you can use to customize your own B2B writing career. We also have our Forever Free Foundations course out with a slight change in our audience. The more we think about who we're here to serve, that audience has been kind of shifting from a super beginner B2B writer who's never been paid to write to advanced B2B writer who needs to learn more about interviewing thought leadership experts. So as we get more clarity around who we're here to serve, we're moving more into that intermediate space where we want to fill in the gaps, because everybody got into B2B writing by accident. So you never know what it is that you missed or what else there is that you could be using to be an even better writer right now. So we've tweaked our website copy and our email just a little bit to focus more on, you know, people who are already in B2B writing and want to improve those skills. Now, there's still always going to be a place for the newbie and anyone who wants to move into B2B writing for the first time, because that's how we all started. But we are going to move forward focusing our resources on intermediate writers, advanced writers, and generally helping form the craft of B2B writing. And I'm really excited about, we're going to retire the newbie Facebook group, which has about 4,500 people in it, but it's not super concentrated with people participating. We're going to shut that group down on Friday in March, the last Friday in March, and we're going to make room for an invite-only, subscribers-only group that hopefully will be a little more concentrated and bring in people who are, you know, actively writing white papers, webinars, case studies, articles, so we can bring some best practices to one place and start releasing some standards around these topics. Start releasing some standards around these formats, which I'm really excited about. So stay tuned, head to that website beyond the Friday update newsletter, and you will get everything you need to know about the community. Thanks for listening.